Hello, One Song Nation. Diala Riddle here. Luxury and I are hard at work making new episodes of the show. We've got a lot of new stuff coming up in about 2 weeks that we are really excited about, including a very special Valentine's Day episode for you romantics out there. So while Luxury and I are hard at work isolating stems, researching obscure old drum machines, and thinking about why the songs we share really matter, I wanted to share an early episode that some of you newer listeners may have missed. It's a song that means a lot to me, and it meant a lot to hip-hop. It's one of the last singles to feature one of the greatest rappers of all time, to many, the greatest rapper of all time. And importantly, it ushered out one kind of hip-hop sound and ushered in a whole new era. Before I play you the episode, a quick note. We recorded this episode before the allegations against Sean Diddy Combs were made public. So now, from the One Song Archive, it's Mo Money, Mo Problems. Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
I'm director, actor, writer, and sometimes DJ Diala Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury.
And this is One Song, the show where we deconstruct and celebrate some of your favorite songs from the past 60 years in music history and tell you why it deserves one more listen.
That's right.
Yo, Luxury, what's up with you?
Man, it's been quite the week. It's been a big week. I'm exhausted. I'm tired.
Why was it a big week?
As EPMD would say, if you're tired, go and take a nap. Do we have time for a nap? I don't have time for a
nap. You know what? That was a diss back when he said it, but now that we're a little older, like it's like, go take a nap. Why, yes, I will, Eric Sermon.
It's a kind suggestion now. Like, thank you. I don't mind if I do.
I am tired. Was it the
eyes? As a matter of fact, we're too...
EPMD was looking out for us.
But I am not too tired to have an hour-long chat with my buddy Diala about music. I'm kind of pumped. I got to be honest with you.
Oh, okay. Well, should we get this thing started?
Let's do it.
If you didn't know, this August is the 50th anniversary of the birth of hip-hop. We'll be covering a lot of hip-hop songs, but I'm excited to say that today's song comes at literally the halfway point in hip-hop's history. So if you consider 1973 the beginning,
right,
we are now firmly planted in 1997. Okay, it's not granted. It's not 1998, but 1997, about as clear as a halfway mark as we can get. And it marks a shift in how mainstream hip-hop is going to become. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that the main artist on this song, never got a chance to see it.
Oh, my God. Such a build-up. The suspense. Can we... what is the song? We all want to know.
Well, get ready, because today we're talking about the notorious B.I.G., Puff Daddy, and Mace on their hit song, Mo Money, Mo Problems.
No info for the DEA. Federal agents mad cause the flagrant tapped myself and the phone in the basement.
By the way, I had a quick question for you. It is the 50th anniversary, technically, of Kool Herc throwing that party at the Rec Room at 120 Sedgwick.
In the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Yeah.
Do you agree that that should be the beginning of hip-hop?
You know, without stepping into the minefield of what is hip-hop, I think No, because that's a whole nother episode.
That's a whole nother episode.
And I really want to spend some time talking about Biggie,
money and problems.
But I do think that, you know, you've got the four avenues of hip-hop present in some form at that party, according to the people who were there.
Yeah.
You know, you've got teenagers breakdancing, emceeing, you know, on the turntables.
There may have been some
graffiti.
Some graffiti
there,
too. Yeah,
exactly. Like, you know, again, there are endless books written about this, but I think that
to have those four avenues come together,
yeah,
you know, in
a public setting
way, and to have those kids realize that they had sort of stumbled on something, a new recipe,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah.
You know, I honor it. I mean, like, it's hard to put your finger on it and to also think about how far we've come.
Right.
Like, you know, nowadays you can definitely go to a hip hop show and there's no graffiti in sight.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's very little
graffiti. And the
b-boying
is exactly. Gone downhill a little.
You know,
right.
Things are going to change in 50 years. And I actually think that's the most beautiful thing about hip hop.
Right.
Is that anytime somebody, you know, tries to over intellectualize it or come along and constrain it in the way that, like, you know, rock journalism has sort of constrained rock music.
Right.
I feel like hip hop's like, that's not even the rubric we're using anymore.
You know what I was going to say that seems interesting to just sort of dawn on me is like we're talking about a live moment, and like that as the crux of the birth of a genre makes so much sense because hip hop happened in a room with people experiencing it, experiencing there was a DJ on the turntables, there were MCs, there were B-boys. It was all happening in a live setting. And we now kind of think of it as a genre that we choose to listen to and maybe we go to a show. But the birth of hip hop is the birth happens in a live setting, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
There weren't any recordings yet. There were no hip hop records out yet.
Right.
And I think nowadays, if there are new genres being invented, I think they're not happening in live settings.
Oh, yeah. You don't need a $5,000 studio or a performance at Carnegie Hall. It's usually people on their laptops.
Piecing together music in their bedrooms.
Totally.
You know? Interesting habit.
But hip hop's 50. Hip hop can, you know, definitely get into a movie for a little bit cheaper now
if
it goes to a movie. But if hip hop's 50, it probably does prefer going to theaters.
Midlife
for
crisis for
But when it was in its, you know, mid-20s, this song came out. And this song means so much to hip hop, I feel. We didn't know it necessarily at the time. And some of this is looking back, but I just think that this is one of the seminal hip hop tracks. And you can sort of see where hip hop goes off in a different direction. Not just for Mo Money, Mo Problems, but Life After Death in general. That album, such a major, you know, moment in hip-hop history that I thought we'd spend some time talking
about. I'm excited. I can't wait to, like, get educated from your POV.
Well, that's why I'm going to break down the essentials.
Yeah.
This song was released after Biggie died, and I would point out after Tupac died about 9 months before him in 1997. This was on Biggie's second and final album, Life After Death, as I said. We all know that Biggie's real name was Christopher Wallace. He was fatally shot in Los Angeles after attending an after party. And Life After Death was literally released 16 days after his murder.
And by the way, quick question for you. The Biggie Smalls Notorious B.I.G. thing. There's a transition that happens, right? Because he starts out as Biggie.
He starts off as Biggie
And then there's
Smalls.
Like a lawsuit, right? From
well,
some
there was
white
like a
Biggie.
Rapper named Big E Smalls.
It was a white
Smalls.
Rapper.
Yeah.
There's a white guy named Biggie Smalls who, like, threatened a lawsuit or something, and so then he made the conversion? Is that what happened?
I don't know if it was threatening. I mean, like, you know, nowadays you see things on social media that suggest that it goes really deep in terms of, like, you know, Biggie Smalls staking out not just the name, but, like, the use of certain samples. I'm not going to touch that either. I feel like that's a different kind of briar patch. But obviously, at some point, he needed to change his name for legal reasons, and he became the Notorious B.I.G.
Okay, so we're gonna call him Big. I'm just going to go by Big today.
We might call him everything.
We can call him whatever we want.
Might
Big
call
Papa.
Him Biggie. Might call him, you know, King of New York. We might call him a lot of things.
Man has a lot of names.
Might call him Frank White. I love the fact that he called himself Frank White because, like, clearly, like, rappers have a lot of time to watch movies when they're on tour. And I find that, like, they're usually some of the most voracious consumers of movies. So, like, they'll see a movie. He'll be like, yo, Christopher Walken played Frank White in King of New York.
Oh, is that where
I'm going to drop that name.
No way. I love that.
But you know what's crazy is, like, this was also a concept album. You know, it picks up where the last song on his debut album, which I think is, you know, just an amazing album, Ready to Die, amazing album. It picks off where that album left off. And, you know, that song, that last song, I believe, is called Suicidal Thoughts. You know, so this was Life After Death, you know, which made a lot of sense at the time. And Mo Money, Mo Problems was a monster hit, officially ushering in what some people call the shiny suit era of hip hop. I mean, like, you know, I remember Fat Joe's first video, You Gotta Flow Joe. He had 80 guys in the Bronx standing on pure rubble. Everybody had on, you know, like the fat jackets and like the Timbos. And like, no, nowadays, like when Puffy takes over hip hop, when Puffy and Biggie, I should say, take over hip hop, everybody's wearing these shiny suits. You know, in the videos, you know, even people who weren't about that before. I'll never forget. I remember Mike Geronimo, one of my favorite New York rappers. And if anybody wants to ever check out Mike Geronimo, he's got some great songs. The Natural, Master I See. He's got a song called Time to Build, which is the first appearance. I'm going to talk in comic book terms. It's the first appearance of DMX, Ja Rule, and Jay-Z all on one cut.
Oh, wow. That's canon.
But they're all featured. And, and Mike Geronimo is the star of the track. And it's just funny because, like, 3 years later, you know, they're all mega superstars. But I bring up Mike Geronimo just to say that, like, he was like Gully, you know, like he had that New York swag going. And then literally after Mo Money Mo Problems, Mike Geronimo's next video, he's wearing a shiny suit and everybody's like, oh,
they
you know,
got to him.
The
they
shiny
got to
suits,
him.
The shiny suits.
So I want to dig into the story of the song and the production and how it got made a little bit. So as you probably know, there's a squad working for Bad Boy called the Hitmen. Those are the production team, right? The Hitmen. And, you know,
apparently Stevie J is in there,
Stevie J is in there. Stevie J is the producer, is the co-producer of this song. Now, Puff gets co-producer credit, but when you say producer, it can mean a lot of things. There's a spectrum of what producer means.
Yeah.
Puff Daddy is not the Kanye type of producer. He's not like the Premier type of producer. He's not in there with the MPC making the beats. But what he is doing, and this is kind of worth talking about in this topic, because he is a visionary for whatever, lots of things that can be said about Diddy or Puff at the time. What he is he's the guy that's like has the grand master vision. Like, we're going to do this. We're going to hit this up. And he leans back and he directs people what they're going to do musically in the track.
I also got the sense he would be like, you know what? I don't like those bells right there.
That's right.
Bring down
that
bass
really
a little
crucial.
Bit. Or
that's,
bring
I think
up
that's,
that snare a little bit.
That's
like,
absolutely
you know.
Right. And that's underrated because I think sometimes people think, well, unless you're touching the faders, are you really making anything? And the answer is yes. That is a very, Rick Rubin is a very famous modern example of someone who's leaning back in the chair, making choices and kind of helping with the big picture. You know what? Let's trash all the songs and write completely new ones, you know?
It's sort of like what a director does when he's looking over his editor's shoulder.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the cinematographer. Director's not holding the camera usually.
Exactly. Almost never.
Almost
nowadays.
Never, right. Yeah. But I say all that, and in this case, from what I understand, the actual choice to flip the sample, the Diana Ross sample, came from Mace, who is apparently for real. And I
never knew that.
I found a couple instances of him talking on some footage of him, like where he's still mad because it was his idea and he brought it to
and
Stevie
he didn't
J.
get a producer.
He
credit.
Wanted it for himself, and Stevie's like, "That's great, let's do it." And then Puff comes in and he's like, "Oh, this is for big."
That explains why I think this is going to be controversial.
Do it. Go there.
I think that Biggie's verse is obviously a classic Biggie verse, but I think Mace has the best verse. And that's probably because he found the track and he felt the greatest connection to this song. That's really interesting
that's
that you bring that up. Because I think it's like a solid mid-class Biggie verse. I can think of a lot of Biggie verses where I'm like, oh, Biggie just proved he's the GOAT. This is not really one of those verses. And I do feel like the Mace, who's hot, who's not, like, he comes in on the track with a certain connection to it that, it doesn't surprise me. He's the one who found the sample.
Right. And it's interesting you mention that because that does become one of the more iconic lines from the song. We'll get into it in a bit, but that becomes an interpolation for Drake later. The Mace, who's hot, who's not, those bars may be more than the Biggie bars.
And there may be some sub, I don't know what we would call it back in the, wasn't subtweeting back then, but maybe there's some subbing of who shot you. Yeah, there's some shade maybe directed at a certain other famous rapper, Tupac. There's a lot of things that could rhyme with Tupac at the beginning of that Mace verse.
Okay, you're going to have to talk about that a little bit later. That sounds cool. So going back to the story, how the song gets made, around 96, Puff brings his stable, the Hitmen. They go to Trinidad, and they're like, we're just going to get out of town. We're going to get out of the mindset of all this stuff going down, and we're just going to make music.
Wow.
So they spend 6 weeks in hotels in Trinidad. They got two rooms set up.
Sounds like a dream.
With engineers, and they just have the Hitmen going through, track, 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 crank, crank, crank. And a lot of the stuff that ends up on Puff's solo album, but also on the Biggie
Puff
record.
Puff Daddy and the Family.
A lot of that stuff
comes
out
of an album that I feel like goes very much hand in hand, even with the sort of like sepia tone album art.
It came out a week later, right? The Puff album comes out a week after the Mo Money Mo Problems comes out in 97, if you can believe it.
Wow.
Yeah. So basically, it was Mace's idea to flip the I'm Coming Out sample. He just came into the studio, was like, I got a great one. Give it to me. Give me I'm Coming Out. This is this 1980 huge hit for Diana Ross, which is effectively a Chic song with Diana Ross singing it, because it's Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson. It's the band Chic playing a song, and Diana Ross is singing on top.
Yeah.
And that actually ends up being controversial later. Diana Ross doesn't like the song. She has all the production redone. The versions you end up hearing are remixed by other people, and she never works with Chic again, which is ironic because it's a huge hit. It's everyone's favorite Diana Ross album.
It's a great album.
It's a great album.
It's a great album. And I've listened to the original Chic version of all these songs, and they sound pretty much the same.
Pretty similar.
What got released.
I agree. There's very subtle differences. But yeah. So the Diana Ross sample, I want to play it for you, because one thing that's interesting that most people don't know is, in the first place, you're hearing a pretty wholesale four-bar loop of I'm Coming Out.
Right.
In fact, when the song starts, you're like, oh, the Diana Ross is on the radio. Like, it literally just is the song until you get that wooka 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 coming in.
Which was the beef that a lot of us had with Puffy and Bad Boy Records in general, was that, you know, when you have people like DJ Premier who take obscure records, flip them into like pretty much brand new compositions by just the way they chop them up. And, you know, like DJ Premier, Pete Rock, like these guys are like, you know, they're doing what Dilla will do in the 2000s.
Right.
But like Puffy and them, they were just like, I may even let you know, we take hits from the 80s. Don't
literally,
it sound so crazy.
He told you what they were doing. Yeah, so it sounds like it's a single four-bar loop, but what's actually going on is a little more complicated. I'm going to play it for you. There's actually two samples that are being layered here. So here's the first Diana Ross sample. And here's the second sample. And then I'll play them both together so you can hear how they blend. Something that's really cool when you hear those samples isolated is you hear all the grit and crackle, because these are vinyl records that are being sampled. This is still the era pre-digital. There are CDs and such, but they're sampling these records. They're sampling the vinyl copies of the record, so you get all the grit. All right, now I'll play them together. Oh, and I almost left one thing out. There's actually a third layer that comes in after every, I think, 16 bars. Which is just that first beat, that first downbeat. One, two, three, four. That's all that was.
By the way, I remember that when this Diana Ross sample was used in Mo Money, Mo Problems, it caused a little bit of controversy at the time. You know, there were whispers of like, you know, I'm Coming Out, why Puffy using, you know, why did he sample a gay anthem? You know what I mean? Like, this is in the less, you know, the less woke era of hip hop, where like, you know, there was pretty rampant
homophobia.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like, I think about some of the songs we used to play then that, like, nowadays, like, you'll be doing an old school set and you'll forget, like, you know, a certain word or a certain something's coming up in the song. You're like, ooh, damn.
That didn't age well. Didn't age well. We got to listen to the sample one more time, because there's something about the use of it, the choice, like literally the selection, not just what I played for you, which is the layering, but the selection of a huge 1980 massive disco hit that's important to talk about. I got a question for you, y'all. Does this feel like, this is something Q-Tip would crate dig and put in a Tribe Called Quest song? Does this qualify as a sample, in your opinion, that would be used in a De La Soul or a...
Well, it's how they use it, right? Like, if you go back and listen to, you know, Me, Myself, and I, like, they didn't drastically change, you know, that sample. Like, there were times when Buddy, which is a De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, you know, classic, really doesn't do that much to change the song that they sampled there. You know, like they took a snippet that they liked and put it out there. I think what happened was the West Coast blew up really big, and Dre, you know, around the time of the Chronic is a seminal album. We could spend a whole episode talking about that. But on the Chronic, they didn't do sort of like the DJ Premier, Pete Rock.
No, I saw it's interpolations,
sampling.
Not samples.
There was a lot of interpolations, but they were also just taking, like, you know, Swing Down, Sweet Chariot, Stop and Let Me Ride. Like, they just took the song and rapped over it.
Right.
And And not even in the subversive way, I would argue that like someone like Ghostface Killah will rap over a song that he literally didn't change. Like he'll literally just put on a song. You'll still hear the vocals singing underneath. It would be like, yo, I saw a baby doll. You know, like it's just like, man, he didn't change a damn thing. This is somewhere in between. And there were definitely rumblings that what they were doing was like, you know, taking a pop song from a previous era, you know, probably 20 years ago. And then just rapping over it. So, yes, absolutely. I do consider it a sample, but understand that this type of sampling, though popular with the public, did get critiqued by a lot of their fellow artists.
I think when you got producers crate digging, you know, in the sort of classic, like I mentioned Q-Tip and or Dilla or whoever, like this is, there's a art to it, which is both the portion of the song, which I think you were referring to, but also like, what is the song?
Yeah.
And the more obscure, the better is kind of what I was alluding to a little bit with the Q-Tip mention.
Yes.
So what's happening here is that that is not important to the Hitmen. The Hitmen, they're called the Hitmen. Let's take a hit and make a hit. It's right there in the title. There's no surprises going on.
But you
here.
Know, I will say that like, you know, some of this, when you look back now, you do realize like there, anybody could have done this. They did it effectively.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so to a certain extent, I'm not even adopting, you know, an argument that would have been made against the critics back then. Oh, y'all just hating because we're selling out, you know, all these CDs and shows. I'm not making that case about it. I'm not saying any old thing that works with the public is automatically good. But the fact is the fact that they took a song, a Diana Ross song that at that point in my life, I'd never heard this song, you know, like I just hadn't. And I was like, oh, man, that, you know, that sounds really cool. So to a certain extent, the youth will sort of drive the way. You know what I mean? Like a song that was 20 years old at the point that I was probably 18, you know, that's going to be a brand new song to a certain extent if it's an album cut.
And you probably feel the history. You can tell that what's being,
you can tell
what's
being
sampled
song.
It's a song that is from the past, whether or not you were familiar with it. Personally.
Right.
Right. And that gives it something. That gives it something that makes it hip-hop, probably.
Absolutely. I mean, again, place everything in its context. This is the late 90s. Boogie Nights is in theaters. Puffy's sampling disco. Like, disco was back in a big way in the end of the 90s because, you know, again, it was 20 years old, and anybody who was, like, you know, under 30 thought, oh, wow, this is fun. We're taking our parents' music.
You and you're right. You kind of alluded to it in the opening. It's like it's a quarter century after the beginning of hip-hop, which begins with disco and funk.
Yeah.
But we're going back with this period of West Coast interpolations and kind of slowed down George Clinton, whatever, this, that, and the other. We're kind of going back to hip-hop origins.
Exactly.
With tracks like this one.
Exactly. And to your point, it wasn't just Diana Ross. Like, they were literally taking so many things from, you know, 15 and 20 years ago. Yeah. So he didn't just hit up Diana Ross. He took Bowie for a spin.
Right.
Yo, yo, this makes, you know what I'm saying? You got niggas that don't like me for whatever reason. You got niggas that don't want to see me, bitch. You got niggas that's mad because I'm always with they bitch.
It's the same thing. The song starts and you're like, oh, here comes David Bowie's Let's Dance. It's the same thing as with Mo' Money, More Problems. The song starts with it. It could be the original song. It's only slightly modified. It's sort of pitched down, a little slowed down. Right.
Listen, not everybody was in love with this kind of sampling back then. And, and some people are still like, oh, no, you know, I gotta have, you know, that the fact that like someone like Q-Tip can take a mini Ripperton song and take the quietest part of the song and then flip it into, you know, a number of songs. A number of Q-Tip songs are based off of Minnie Riperton's songs. Like, you know, to me, that is the art. But, you know, but this was something different. This was Puffy taking pop music back from the West Coast. Because by this point, Snoop is off death row. You know, the prize is for the taking. And for, you know, the first couple of years after Biggie's gone, New York definitely reasserted its dominance.
Yeah.
You know, because you had Puffy, you had Busta Rhymes releasing, you know, his solo records. He'd moved on from Leaders of the New School. He's not really claiming native tongues in the same way.
We're in the Wu-Tang era.
Wu-Tang, I would argue, is not really on the scene right now either. I think Wu-Tang has like this amazing period from like 93 to 97, 98, where they're driving the culture. But I remember, I think the only album that came out for Wu-Tang in like 97, 98 might have been like Inspecta Deck or something like that.
They know, passed like, the torch along to Puff, whether
sure
they liked it or not.
Any torch.
Whether they meant to or not.
I think that what happened was New York discovered how to make hit records in a way that sort of like, you know, and also the South is coming up now. So you've got Jay-Z, Ja Rule, DMX, like that's sort of the new face of New York. Right at this time, I think the RZA was hanging with Quentin Tarantino and doing the Bobby Digital album, you know. But like, you know, this is New York's, you know, dominance. And then 50 Cent comes in,
yeah.
But then sometime around the time 50 Cent comes in and Eminem is a huge major pop star, then the South comes in,
right?
And all this swings on a pivot that we call Life After Death, aka Mo Money, Mo Problem single.
Just to add one more point, by the way, to the sample transformation in favor of like the, you know, the cred reputations of the Hitman or Puff in general. You know, it is important to mention that this is a transformed sample, not just because of the layering, but because it's layered furthermore with additional instrumentation. So what Stevie J does, and I think out of the Hitman, he was known to be one of the most instrumentally gifted. Yeah. He's programming some beats, and I'm going to play for them right now. And when you hear it isolated,
that's a very strong scratch.
That's a very strong scratch. And when you hear it isolated, you can kind of hear the song. That is the momentum of the song. The beat of the song is not the disco beat. It's really coming from the additional material that Stevie J adds, not the least of which is the bass line, which is completely original.
Is that a live bass?
That's a synthesizer, and he's playing that part on a synth, layered. By the way, probably the reason for it is that in the mix, when you've got a sample and you've got all these beats, there's not a lot of room left for where the bass like content would go to not just blow up your speakers. So when you play a synth, it's a lot more controllable. You can kind of control where it sits in the mix, basically. So I'll put that together with the sample, and you can hear how the blend is actually very artful.
Can I just say, as a DJ, this was a hard record to mix in. It was like, because it comes in like, vah! Like it, you kind of want like
no
at least
mixing
like,
room.
Yeah, like or top. I feel like some producers will give you like a little snare hit, like a cat.
Here it comes, right.
You know, like something like that. But like, I remember this was a hard one.
Just immediate. It's now. It's starting now.
I remember that. I mean, you know, like, and also back in the vinyl days, like you'd pull the record back, and when you scratch it in, like it would actually jump one beat ahead, and so coming crazy, and everybody would look at you.
Not DJ friendly, but not made by DJs necessarily.
No, these not made by
hit DJ. Record producers for
you
the
know,
radio.
Things changed when we moved to laptops and CDs on, because then there was no skipping. But in the skipping days, this one was a little hard.
But you're making such an interesting point, because like we were just talking about the birth of hip hop being in a room. I think we're at a moment in hip hop where hip hop is for the radio. Like literally, let's make a hit for the radio is the intention behind this track. And they didn't really consider DJs needing a little time to get the record set up.
But this song is a pivot, because to me, you know, like I grew up in the South, I grew up in Atlanta, but to me, most of the early 90s hip hop that came out of New York was grimy and gritty. You know, it was Daz FX, it was Mobb Deep. Nas's first album, Illmatic, is like an ode to like a pre-Giuliani New York. You know what I mean? Like, and that was what everybody thought of when they thought of New York. It was like rhymes and skills, and it wasn't about, you know, all these material things. It was about like really people don't even talk about like Redman and K-Solo. And we were talking a little bit earlier about EPMD, and Rakim is sort of the birth of that. And KRS-One is sort of the birth of that. And then something happened. I'm still convinced it's because everybody saw the West Coast. The West Coast was selling platinum. They were going platinum. You know what I mean?
They wanted
some of
that.
We're not talking about MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. Like, we're not talking about like the highest selling rappers. We're talking about like the G-Funk sound, everything that Dre put out after the Chronic, you know, starting with Nothing But a G Thing, but like everything they did was just huge. And then Doggy Style got the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, and it was like people were really paying attention to hip hop in a different way. It was like the beginning of hip hop's ascension to slowly replacing rock as like the music of the youth culture. And I truly think that like the East Coast saw this, you know, people like Tribe Called Quest, Mobb Deep to a certain extent, like, you know, which are not really that far apart when you think about, like, both of them are from Queens, you know what I mean? Like, they were watching this, they're like, well, you know, we're gonna be the protectors of hip hop as art. And I think what Puffy did by bringing somebody as talented as Biggie, as a lyricist, he brought somebody who's unassailable. You can't ever claim Biggie didn't have lyrics, he didn't have flow. But he put it with production that was as shiny and as pop-driven as what Dre was doing on the West Coast.
Right,
well and said. That potent mix sort of came together. You start seeing the beginnings of it on Ready to Die, but Ready to Die is still a very sort of like New York gritty album, you know what I mean? But like by the time we get to Life After Death, it's a different Biggie, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like he's doing, you know, songs with Jay-Z. He's doing songs with, I think he's got a song with R. Kelly on there. You know, he's bridging that gap between R&B listeners and hip hop.
Right.
And again, Mo Money, Mo Problems, in its shiny suit glory, is a song that you don't have to be like wearing a Scully. And, you know, those kind of gloves that everybody wore and like a puffy jacket. Like, no, you can be an R&B listener.
Well, I was just going to ask you that
appreciate
part
what Biggie's bringing.
Part of what we don't like to do, but collectively as people and also on the show, is like get a little too like going down the rabbit hole of like pinning down definitions, because that's just a waste of everyone's energy. However, it does. I'm curious to know your opinion. Like, is this track a hip hop track, a pop track, an R&B track? Does it matter, or what would if it's a pie? What's the allocation? Because I think that would be an easier question to answer with a Nas track with New York State. I mean, like that's a hip hop track, and what is this?
Look, I think almost everything on Life After Death is absolutely hip hop. All I'm saying is that you take hip hop's, you know, arguably hip hop's greatest lyricist,
and going on the radio makes it a pop song only after the fact. Is that what
guess what I'm saying, you take hip-hop's greatest lyricist and you put him over not the DJ Premier, you know, one of my favorite songs on Life After Death is I Got a Story to Tell. I think it's a fantastic track, but that track is not meant to push the album to sell records or to, you know, build Biggie's fan base. That's a song for the streets,
right?
That's I Got a
they're
Story
mixing
to
it
tell.
Up on the record.
More Money, More Problems, you know. Sky's the Limit, I think, is on this album. These are songs that are very smooth,
right?
Very Big Papa Biggie.
Yeah.
You know, I said we were going to give him a million names in this episode. By the time Big Papa Biggie comes out,
you made a promise and you're delivering. Yeah.
That dude, he can rap over any smooth song, you know, and make it hot. By the way, when Hypnotize comes out, there were a lot of people who were like, oh, Biggie just released a West Coast record.
Right. For whatever reason, like a West Coast record. Yeah.
Herb Alpert. Felt like a really West Coast
jazz.
Thing to
it
do.
It does sound like a...
But, you know, again, Biggie showed the industry that you didn't have to sacrifice your lyricism to sell a lot of records. All you had to do was change the production. And I think that you have to give him credit because what he sort of opened the door for was, you know, label mates 112 on the R&B front, Mary J. Blige, you know, she comes in, the real love... remix has Biggie on it. Look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. You know, like Biggie was always saying, like, hey, we can sell records too. We just got to give people something different. And you see it in 112, you see it in Mace, you see it in The Lox, you know, Total. But you know, like, it's because of Bad Boy's success with this format that we got three of, I think, just seminal New York labels. You got Rough Riders, which gave us DMX and Swiss Beats. You had Murder, Inc., which gave us Ja Rule and Ashanti. And you had Rockefeller, which gave us Jay-Z. And eventually
Kanye.
Cam'ron and Dipset and Kanye West. And, you know, these labels, these New York-based labels, you know, they were watching what Puffy was doing at Bad Boy. Say it was a Violator label, you know, also great label at this time. and everybody was doing that while Raucous was over here sort of keeping it New York true, doing its stuff with Mos Def and Black Star, you know, and a rapper named Socrates, which I remember because everybody on the scene was like, Socrates is the best freestyling rapper in New York. And, you know, sometimes those rappers don't, the best freestyle rapper isn't necessarily the best when it comes to writing.
And we still have the left field stuff, as it were. We still have the like native tongue stuff is still happening. They still exist, but they are kind of on the down?
But you know, it's always like, and let me be very clear. I think Wu-Tang makes great records from 93 till today. And I think that Q-Tip and De La Soul, you know, rest in peace, True Goy. Like, I think that all these people have made great records, but there's a point at which you're driving the culture.
Yeah.
And there's a point at which there are other people driving
the
culture.
Midnight Marauders was sort of the end of their run, right?
Yeah, I think so, because I think by the time Beats, Rhymes, and Life comes out, I think that's the next record. You know, I'm already listening to Outkast at that point. I'm starting to notice that the South got something to say, you know, as
he
famously
said.
Put
he said it.
But to come back to Puffy, I think that Life After Death plants a certain flag in the ground and says,
hey, New York's
this
still
is
around.
New York. And that's what's so ironic.
We're
is
back,
that
baby.
When I mean, like, not that Biggie wasn't already running New York, but this album, which was a double album, you know, would have absolutely he deserved a reign on the top while this album was out. And unfortunately, he just didn't get it. I usually repel at these kind of comparisons, but I consider him a little bit the Kurt Cobain.
Oh, we're going there.
Of hip-hop.
Yay!
And we can say that for later. Let's take a break.
Yeah, I didn't hear
when
anything.
We come back, I'll tell you why I think that the Notorious B.I.G. is sort of like Kurt Cobain in a different genre.
There is so much we need to get into. Is there more show? Is there more show coming up?
I think there's more show. We're going to come back after a quick break. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song, and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
While no one knows what tomorrow may bring, Bridgestone is working toward a more positive outlook. With innovations like developing a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials. It's just one of the many ways Bridgestone is making a difference today, for generations to come. Because that's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Welcome back. So we've been talking about the Biggie, Mace, Puff Daddy classic, Mo Money, Mo Problems. But to understand the two sides of Biggie, we got to go back further than 1997.
Take me back.
Now, I consider myself something of a voracious consumer of mixtapes. And I mean, like, that was how you got, you know, so much hip hop back then. Like sometimes you'd be like, man, I don't even listen to the album, but Jay-Z's mixtape with, you know, DJ, you know.
Is this Envy. The DJ drama era? Is that what this is?
I actually want to give a shout out to our producer, Eric One, because there are two Erics in here, and they can fight to the death over who gets Eric One and Eric Two.
Big E.
But
Big E.
Eric reminded me, DJ Clue.
World famous DJ Clue.
DJ Clue had the greatest mixtapes at the time because there were versions of songs that we will probably never hear again because they were just, they weren't the album version. They weren't the radio version.
We're going to need
to
do.
They were just a guy rapping over the instrument.
We got it. There's going to be a whole episode. We're going to have to do a mixtape episode because that's such a seminal part of the culture.
Let's find them.
Yeah.
Every now and then I go on YouTube and someone has been so kind to upload these mixes. But I remember hearing Biggie very early on. He was one of, he was in the Source's Unsigned Hype 1 month, and that was a big deal. You know, like that was when the Source was really driving things too.
Right.
Like I'll never forget when the Source gave Illmatic, Nas's debut album, the
five mics.
The proverbial five mics. Like, everybody's like, yo, Nas got five mics.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
They're saying they're no notes. Like, this is the perfect album. And by the way, if you go back and listen to Illmatic now, can I just say, represent? I might have cut that song.
It's got some sluggish.
I think that song, I still believe we got to do classic album, worst song. That should be a segment.
Absolutely.
Every album, almost every album has a song you would cut.
I got ideas.
But I remember Biggie Smalls, the first time I heard him on a mixtape, and it was the song Party and Bullshit.
Party and Bullshit.
It's like kicks, honeys want to chat, but all we want to know is where the party at. And can I bring my gat? If not, I hope I don't get shot. Better throw my vest on my chest, because niggas is a mess. It don't take nothing but front for me to start something. Bugging and bucking at niggas like I was duck hunting.
And Party and Bullshit, I remember everybody's like, yo, this dude is sick and he's really ill and like, you know, where the party at? And can I bring my gat? I was like, oh, don't let him in our party.
We
don't want any gats at our party. But like that, I mean, you can hear Biggie was rapping differently than he's in a high register. He's like, you know, he's like that grimy street kid.
Yeah.
Out of Brooklyn.
It just
you know
sounds
what
different.
I mean?
It just sounds
just
so
sounds
different.
Really different than what he's going to end up sounding like. And there was something about the way Biggie used his voice and the way he was weaving a story. If you go back and listen to that one and some of his earlier songs. I mean, this is the first of our two Biggies. This is how he was introduced to us who were listening to hip hop at the time. And it's ironic because if you go and listen to his first album, Ready to Die, he kind of acknowledges that he had two styles coming into that first album, you know, because on the track Give Me the Loot, it's like a scene where like an actor acts opposite himself.
Yeah.
Like you hear Biggie use both of his voices.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like he's having a conversation
with
himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, on Give Me the Loot.
Right.
One of my favorite Biggie songs of all time. This is Give Me the Loot off of the debut album Ready to Die.
Stick and move, stick and move.
Nigga, you ain't got to explain shit. I've been robbing motherfuckers since the slave ship with the same clip and the same 4-5, 2-point blank, a motherfucker sure to die. That's my word. Nigga even try to vote guard. Have his mother sing it, it's so hard.
Yes, Lord.
That's such a fucked
funny
up
too,
interpolation of Boys to Men, It's So Hard to Say Goodbye. But you know, the first time I heard that song, I remember some people thought it was two rappers on the song.
It's just so different.
And somebody was like, no, that's Biggie rapping both verses. And it's,
that's amazing.
It was subtle enough that, like, you know, some people actually thought it was two different rappers on the song. But there's also just, again, he's using, if you really study the lyrics, he's using different flows for the different voices. Like, their staccatos are a little bit different. And it's violent. I got kids now. Some of these lyrics, I'm like, ah, dang, Big. But like, you know, as a kid back then, I was just like, I was loving it. I was loving it completely. You know, there's a line on there that got edited on all the CDs that came out for Ready to Die. He's got a line on there. It says, don't give a fuck if you're pregnant. Give me the baby rings and the number one mom pendant. And I'll never forget, on every CD, it says, don't give a fuck if you're...
I wouldn't give a fuck if you're in here. Give me the baby rings and the number one mom pendant.
And I was like, there's
what?
So much cursing
that's
on this
word,
album. That's blue. The word that Diddy
that's
was like, you've gone too far, Biggie. This is not freaking acceptable. But it's almost like the George Clooney approach to making a movie, like, or having a movie career through most of the 2000s. Clooney would do a big budget movie,
Soderbergh.
And then he would go off and do a small movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like the both Biggie albums, to a certain extent, have songs for the streets and then a song made for radio. And not that Diddy, you know, invented this as a strategy to get artist play, but it definitely felt like he perfected it for the 90s, especially on the East Coast.
Right.
You know, because to this day, when I think about that album, I think about, oh, that's my favorite song. Like, The Warning is a great song, but it comes on right after a song that you feel like was maybe made at least for the mix shows being black radio shows at night.
Yeah.
So they would play songs that you wouldn't hear during the daytime, but they were still acceptable enough that you could play them at some time.
And they're covering all the different markets, all the different potential audiences.
100%. Basically, Biggie, he cracked that code on how to go both mainstream without losing his street appeal. And that was sort of the potent nature of the second Biggie. The Biggie who, you know, some say the X makes the sex spectacular. Let me lick you on your neck and the back and the, like, that's a different.
Oh, I love your Biggie.
Like, he's, thank
you. I can't listen all day.
But that is a guy who's rapping for, you know, potentially R&B fans.
Yeah.
Just still trying to keep it a little grimy, but, you know, not the same as the Biggie we heard on that other song.
Right.
And it's that second Biggie we get a lot more of on Life After Death. Let me ask you, do you have his vocals on Mo Money, Mo Problems?
I got them teed up right here. I got the acapella.
Where are you getting this stuff? Are we going to get, are people going to come find us in the studio and kill us? Because, like, you know, it's one thing if it's like, here's some ELO sample.
Hey, man, it's one of my special skills.
But, like, I don't want Diddy coming down like, yo, is this serious? Yo,
I got friends in high places. That's all I can say. Shall we listen to some?
We need friends here.
I'm your friend here. What are you saying?
No,
you have a friendship. Come on.
I just don't want to be like, yo, who leaked that stuff to Luxury? We're not cool with that.
Well, we're going to listen anyway because it's pretty hair-raising on the back of the neck. Let's listen. This is Isolated Biggie Smalls.
My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, lyrical dream. I be that. Catch your seat at all events bent. Gats in holsters, girls on shoulders. Playboy, I told you. Me and Mike's to me. Bruise too much, I lose too much.
Okay, I got to say a couple of things about this. One is that Biggie famously didn't take paper into the studio.
Yeah.
He was completely off book or memorized, however you want to put it.
Two of the first.
And Jay-Z, same way. So that part of it is always amazing to me. How dialed in you have to be to.
He's writing them in his head.
And not writing them in his head, but it's in his head. It's in his head. But here's what I've always, because I've always struggled with the idea that Biggie died when he was 24 years old. That's a 24-year-old. And I hear it for the first time in my entire life. I can hear a 24-year-old rapping because you have the vocals with no treatment on it.
Yeah.
I feel like
you're
when they put
the
it
in
the
room,
track,
right?
It's a deeper, like, that sounds like a 24-year-old. When I hear the finished track, I hear a person who I will never be older than. You know, like, oh, wow. He always sounds like a deeper registered voice. That is crazy.
And the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, miracle dream. I be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. Gats and holsters, girls on shoulders. Playboy, I told ya. Me and Mike's to me. Lose too much, I lose too much.
One of the things I love about hearing and playing and sharing these isolated vocals is that you really hear the human being. You even hear the, like, the uhs and the, like, the headphone bleed. You're picturing Biggie as a human being.
Yes.
And that's who's in the room with you.
He's not a voice on high.
Right.
With all the reverb
and he's not kind of enveloped and protected by the musical bed and the beat and the whole and everything else going on. He is just a human, a vulnerable person.
He's a 24-year-old kid.
And he's a 24-year-old
with
kid.
With amazing talent.
Yeah.
And in some ways it's so tragic that he'd be cut down so early. You know what I mean?
It really is. And something else that really comes clear when you listen to the isolated vocals, I mean, you hear everything we've been talking about. You hear his flow, the unusual rhyme schemes where he's placing rhymes not just at the end of a line and then rhyming it the next time. There's rhymes within the line. There'll be a word at the end of a line that gets rhymed twice and then there's a new rhyme. All that stuff is mixed up in addition to his choice of where to place the syllables in time. So what's really interesting is when you learn that he had a childhood friend, there's a guy in the neighborhood who was a jazz cat, like who played with Miles Davis, like a real guy named Donald Harrison. That took him under his wing, that saw something innately in Christopher Wallace, and took him in. And young Chris would go to his house, and they would play jazz records. He'd play Max Roach records and point out in, like, the drum solos, like, what he was doing and what was interesting about it. So thinking about the syncopation, the idea that the choices a drummer makes are about how to surprise the ear, how to do something syncopated, which means against the beat, that would be unexpected and interesting. That, I think, really sunk in with Biggie when you think about what he's doing with his choice of
Absolutely.
Where to put the syllables yeah. in the air, like when to say something and when to give it a little bit of space is so unusual.
You and I have never talked about this ever.
Okay.
Oh, so wow. I'm just amazed and happy that you've brought this up. What you're saying is 100% right. And what I've heard somebody else far smarter than myself say online was the difference between Tupac and Biggie's flows was that Biggie was almost like using his voice as a jazz instrument. And
Absolutely.
Tupac was using his voice as a preacher. So
that is great.
He's like,
oh
you know,
God.
Like in the meat of it. Like, it's like,
love
he
that.
Almost sounds like Martin Luther King.
And it's melodic like a preacher too, right?
Yes.
I love that.
But Biggie, like you said, he's hitting, sometimes he's right on the beat, but he's got so much rhythm, he can go off the beat and then bring it back to the beat.
And it sounds so casual and easy. He's not breaking a sweat while he's doing
it. No, it comes very natural to him. If you think about his verse on One More Chance, just the way he could, I'm not gonna rap it right now, but go back and listen to it.
The
number
raps.
Of times that he sort of takes a syllable and stretches it past the fourth beat into the first of the next beat.
Exactly.
And keeps it going. Like, all that stuff is very jazz-like.
It's very drummery, and we're both drummers, so we talk about it. Like, yeah. I remember one of my first, when you're playing the drums and you learn your fills, the first one you learn is tunes, cat, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you come right back on the one, right?
Yeah.
And then a little later on, you learn boom, cat, dun, ba-da, bunk, gong, ba-ka, tunes, cat. You're kind of like not hitting the crash on the one. You're finding new, unexpected
places.
To put the rhythm, to put
so
your
So shout out to
beats.
The public schools where they still have band.
Thank God for that.
So, you know, this episode is sort of like a love letter, you know, to the Notorious B.I.G. And I just think it's so wild. I always try to avoid, you know, drawing direct comparisons between genres, like saying, Tribe Called Quest is the Rolling Stones of hip hop. Like, I really try to
We're
going to
do it
stuff.
On the show a lot, whether you like it or
no,
not.
No, no, no. I almost
Good
refuse.
Content. It's
I
good content.
Think it cheapens.
No.
Everyone, but I
right,
will
we'll
say,
vote on it later.
I will say there's some connecting tissue between, I think, Biggie and Kurt Cobain, in the sense that, you know, there are two major release albums under both of their belts for Nirvana, Nevermind, and In Utero. I know that they did Bleach. Look, Biggie did a whole album worth of you know, stuff before he came out with Ready to Die. But I'm saying there are two sort of major albums that both guys brought out, and then they're gone. You know, then they're just
too
gone.
Soon.
They're gosh, this sounds like I'm trying to make a joke. Their reign on the top is very brief.
Yeah.
You know what
they're
I mean?
Not, they're not around very long.
They're not around, but like their lasting
it.
Impression on right. the genre. Right. And when you see kids who are 11 and 12 now walking around right. with Notorious B.I.G. on their shirt, it just really lets you know just how much impact you can have in just a really brief period
I was
of
just
time.
Having this conversation. Like, if you go around the world, you'll see just like graffiti and spray paint and in t-shirts. Like, who are the iconic artists that have traveled? You'll see, I think you might see some John Lennon. You'll probably see some Bob Marley. And you'll probably see some B.I.G. And you might see some Kurt Cobain. I think there's this small group of artists who went too young that have global impact decades after
And,
their,
you know, I think
passing.
you kind of proved my point in the sense that, like, John Lennon, Tupac, these are guys who have a lot of albums. To me, what connects Kurt with Chris is that they kind of both broke out in 91.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, you're right.
And by, you know, by 97, they're both gone. And you can't imagine the 90s without these icons. You know, it's just their impact was huge.
Yes, perfectly put.
Well, that's our show.
Thank you for sharing the tale of two biggies with me.
Anything for you, my friend. Help me end this thing.
Let's do it together, shall we?
Yes. Who are you again?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I am producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury.
And I'm director, actor, writer, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And this is
One Song. Until next time.
Bye-bye.
One Song is a SiriusXM and Kevin Hart's LOL Radio production. It's hosted by me, Luxury, and my friend Diallo Riddle. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Jordan Colling, with engineering from Marcus Hom. Additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil.
Well, we really hope you enjoyed that episode. To keep up to date with Luxury and I, find us on Instagram. I'm at Diallo, D-I-A-L-L-O, and Luxury is at Luxury, L-U-X-X-U-R-Y. Or on TikTok, where I'm at Diallo Riddle, and he's at Luxury. Or on Twitter, which is now X, and you know what? Instagram and TikTok will be just fine. Stick around, keep your eyes on this feed, and we'll have more for you very soon.
Hey, I'm Paul Scheer.
I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jason Manzoukas.
And we're the hosts of How Did This Get Made?, a comedy podcast where we deconstruct, make fun of, and celebrate the best, worst movies ever made.
Have you ever seen a movie that's so bad that it's actually good? That's what we're talking about.
From blockbuster franchises and made-for-TV romances
to bonkers 80s action flicks and obscure sci-fi musicals, we cover it all.
You can find How Did This Get Made? Wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode, idiot.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.